I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. Last September, Hurricane Maria wreaked havoc on a number of Caribbean islands, including Puerto Rico, causing an estimated $100 billion in damage on that U.S. territory. That includes its power grid, its roads and bridges, water supply, as well as many buildings. Puerto Rico had been struggling under the weight of $70 billion of debt and a poor economy. Thousands have left the island, and those who have stayed are living under new austerity measures. We want to check in with Danica Cotto. She reports on Puerto Rico for the Associated Press and joins us today on Radio Times from San Juan. Danica, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Hi, thank you for having me again.
You're very welcome. Let's start with some of the basics. How many people do not have electricity or running water or some of the basics?
Sure. About more than 20,000 still remain without power. And again, these are customers. So, you know, that could be anywhere between 40,000 to up to 100,000 actual people that remain in the dark nearly 8 months after Hurricane Maria. A much smaller percentage remain without water, probably a couple thousand.
And where the people that do not have electricity, where are they living?
Most of them are still at home. Those who can afford it have generators. You know, there are a lot of elderly people on the island. There are a lot of people with medical needs. And obviously gas is very expensive here as well. So they're trying to turn on the generators when they need to, you know, keep their medication cold, when they need to activate, you know, other medical equipment. And most of these people that are still without power are in the island's central and southeastern region, which is where the Hurricane Maria entered.
What then has taken so long, or what is the problem getting power to everyone on Puerto Rico?
It's been a variety of factors. You know, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, who is overseeing power restoration efforts for the federal government, they maintain, you know, that lack of equipment. You know, a lot of companies in the U.S. mainland had to make a lot of equipment to restore power here in Puerto Rico. In addition, there's a lot of rough terrain. At the beginning, you know, there was the local government did not activate a mutual aid agreement, which would have brought power companies from the U.S. mainland to Puerto Rico. So at this point, crews are saying that the biggest problem is basically terrain. A lot of these people live in very rural areas, very steep areas, you know, that require helicopters to ferry these equipments. And it's very difficult to get to some of these places. They note that two cars would not fit on most roads leading to these places that they have to restore electricity to.
Let me quote you, and this is a report that you had today in the Associated Press. Federal legislators grilled U.S. and Puerto Rican officials on Tuesday on why power has not been fully restored to the island nearly 8 months after Hurricane Maria and as a new storm season looms. You quote a Martin Henrich, Democrat from New Mexico, tens of thousands of Americans are still in the dark. The threat to their health and well-being is real. If 20,000 Texans or Floridians were without power, I can't imagine FEMA saying mission accomplished. It is reprehensible. FEMA's planning on leaving Puerto Rico, what, in the next week or so?
Correct. The date for the Army Corps of Engineers, which FEMA assigned to restore power in Puerto Rico, they're leaving May 18th. So after that, it's still unclear what will happen. The power company has said that it's in discussions with at least three companies that will replace crews from the Army Corps of Engineers. And they expect up to 900 people to be brought in. And that's versus about 600 that the Army Corps, you know, has so far on the island. Many people are doubtful. You know, again, they recall the Whitefish incident, and other troubles with previous companies that the local power authority has hired. And at this point, I mean, there's just a lot of frustration. It's been nearly 8 months, and there's, you know, about 23,000 customers still without power. The hurricane season is about to start, and even the new CEO, Walter Higgins, he said yesterday during the congressional hearing that this is the most difficult part. I mean, those without power live in very hard to reach areas. So it's still unclear when the island will be fully energized.
He also said that the power grid should meet American standards. What does that mean?
they're trying to rebuild the power grid. What they've been doing so far, in the words of one federal official, is basically putting a band-aid. They've been trying to restore power as quickly as possible. And now they want to go back and strengthen the power grid, make it more efficient, use materials that can sustain a Category 4 hurricane. Previously, a lot of these, there was a lack of maintenance as well. Puerto Rico's power company is about $14 billion in debt. And for decades, the infrastructure was not maintained. So that was part of the problem as well.
What is the cost of something like that?
Well, they estimated, in about $10 to $20 billion. Again, it's still very preliminary. They're trying to create microgrids as well. So there's still the plan is still not completed yet. Federal officials have said that by June, they expect to have sort of a more in-depth plan detailing how they'll strengthen the grid. Mm-hmm. The grid, even though people have power restored, there's power outages daily. I mean, just day before yesterday at my house, there were about 7 power outages in 2 hours. Gosh. And this is occurring across the island. There was on April 18th, another island-wide power outage. And so, problems aren't going. Even if you do have power, it's not guaranteed that it'll be there all day.
You mentioned Whitefish, and this was a company in, I believe, Montana that was hired to help fix the grid. And there were, one or two employees in that entire company?
Correct. And I think the biggest criticism that's been slung at Puerto Rico's government is why call this company when it could have activated the mutual aid agreement, which basically means that power companies in the U.S. mainland will come and help Puerto Rico and restore power here. The local government has said they did not do that at the time because they were busy, with other hurricanes that hit the U.S. mainland as well. And that the company Whitefish was not requiring such a big amount of money as other companies up front.
Now, the Federal Control Board approved some austerity measures in April. You reported, Danico, that there were protests last week in San Juan. Help us understand what these measures entail and what's been the response.
Well, it's still up in the air. The government and the board are still at odds over the austerity measures that were approved in April. These, it's a variety of austerity measures. They include a 10% cut to a public pension system that's facing nearly $50 billion in liabilities. It includes the closure of prisons, consolidation of dozens of state agencies, significant reductions in government subsidies to municipalities here, a more than doubling of the tuition at the island's largest public university, and reducing the number of vacation and sick days. And all of that is expected to lead to about $460 million in savings. Now, Puerto Ricans have been living in an 11-year recession. They've been hit by, two large hurricanes. A lot of them are struggling to make ends meet. There's about more than 30,000 businesses that closed. So you add austerity measures to that, it's sort of people cannot take this anymore. Big changes are ahead, and Puerto Ricans are very angry. They're very frustrated and very apprehensive. There was a recent march against these austerity measures and ended up in violence. And there's more marches planned ahead. Some people say that it's still unclear what will be the overall impact of these austerity measures. One board member voted against the plan. She said that she believed the cuts were too deep and they did not offer a realistic path to turn around the crisis.
Does that explain in part why people are leaving Puerto Rico?
Definitely. There's been about roughly 500,000 people that have left Puerto Rico in more than a decade. At the beginning, it was through the economic crisis. And after Hurricane Maria hit, it was a Category 4 storm that caused more than $100 billion in damage. Power obviously has not been fully restored. So there's an estimated 135,000 to about 200,000 people who have left Puerto Rico. Economists say, it's unlikely that many will return, if once they find a job over there, once they find housing, and given the instability of Puerto Rico's future, many believe that they'll just stay in the U.S. mainland.
Is Puerto Rico losing its middle class? I'm assuming the people that are leaving the island probably have some means to be able to do that, or certainly have family on the mainland.
Correct. And a lot of the people that are staying behind, it's an elderly population, and that's another concern. It's an eroding tax base. And on top of it, they're facing cuts to the public pension system. So a lot of middle class people and higher class people have left at the beginning. You're also starting to see more lower class people leaving. You know, once they establish those connections in the U.S. mainland, they sort of have a support system to go there. So that's sort of increased as well, the departure here.
And were families leaving, especially if they have children, were they leaving to find school for their children?
At the beginning, that's what drove most of the people to leave. You know, schools remain closed. Dozens of schools remain closed for more than 3 months, 4 months after the storm. And, you know, Puerto Ricans were not going to stick around and, you know, wait to see what was going to happen. So a lot of them at the beginning said, we'll just enroll our children here for the remainder of the semester. But, you know, again, once they find housing, once they find jobs, it's unlikely that they'll return.
What's the future for Puerto Rico?
It's unclear. A lot of people are asking themselves that, you know, there's more school closures, there's the austerity measures, there's a lot of uncertainty over the economic crisis. There's a big struggle to find jobs here. And a lot of people, or at least the administration that's in place right now, believes that statehood, you know, is the answer. I mean, that way Puerto Rico would get treated equally in some cases. But again, you know, that's why many people are leaving. They don't want to stick around and find out, you know, what the future is on an island that at this point is not offering them much.
Hurricane season, as I understand it, starts on June 1st, so that's a couple of weeks away. Is Puerto Rico in any way prepared for a storm the size and power and scope of Maria?
I don't believe so. You know, there's still a lot of people that have no roofs. They're still depending on the, you know, blue roofs established by the Army Corps of Engineers. Some others have only tarps that, you know, churches and nonprofit organizations have helped them with. The power grid, you know, at this point is still not stable enough, according to some experts, to withstand, you know, a Category 3 storm or higher or even lower. I mean, there's still a lot of issues with outages. You know, just any small storm could, you know, take away power for at least a day or two. So there's still a lot of uncertainty. There's still a lot of belief that Puerto Rico is in no way prepared for another hurricane season like the one we had last year.
Danica, we're almost out of time, but I do remember talking to you about some of the resilience that you had observed after Maria. Are you still seeing that in Puerto Rico?
It's a little sad to say, but I feel some of that has been worn down. You know, as months go by, you know, I see people losing a little bit of their optimism. I don't see that fight in some communities anymore. Basically, people are just tired and they're frustrated. They want answers. They want power. They want change. And they're not seeing that. And I think, you know, hope obviously has diminished the more time goes by without any of these changes. And on top of it, you know, the austerity measures that are coming.
Well, Danica, I always appreciate you joining us on Radio Times and telling us the latest coming from Puerto Rico. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
You're very welcome. And that's Danica Cotto. She reports on Puerto Rico for the Associated Press, joining us from San Juan. We're going to be talking about the 900 families that have come to Philadelphia after Maria, and also the efforts here on the mainland and in Philadelphia and beyond to deal with the needs that they have. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Well, as we just heard, thousands of Puerto Ricans have left Puerto Rico since Hurricane Maria, and some 900 families came to Philadelphia, which has the second largest Puerto Rican population on the mainland. Thousands also evacuated to communities outside of Philadelphia and to cities and towns in New Jersey. They're not only dealing with the trauma of Hurricane Maria, they've been struggling to find housing and work and schools for their children and access to social services. We have two guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studio. Catalina Jaramillo is a reporter for Plan Philly at WHYY and for State Impact Pennsylvania. Catalina, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hi, thank you for having us.
You're very welcome. Also with us is Sierra Ortiz-Blanes, and she's a freelance reporter. Her recent series for the Philadelphia Citizen is called Voices of Maria, and she's interviewed a number of people who have come to Philadelphia from Puerto Rico as a result of Hurricane Maria. Sierra, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you for having us.
You're very welcome. And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation. Sierra, you're leaving tomorrow for Puerto Rico. You're going to a wedding. You've been back and forth several times since Hurricane Maria. First of all, I assume you have family there, and how are they doing?
Yeah, I was born and raised in Puerto Rico, and my entire family is still there. They're doing okay. It's a day-by-day kind of situation.
What does okay mean?
Well, you know, they have their houses, they have jobs. No one passed away in our family, thankfully. But that should not be the minimum. Relative to other people, they're doing well, but that's because they have all, you know, basic services.
And are they living in and around San Juan or in urban areas?
Yeah, in the metropolitan area near San Juan.
We were talking about before going on the air about flying into San Juan and seeing those tarps, those blue tarps on roofs there.
Yeah, in particular, and every time I've traveled back in November, so shortly after the hurricane in December, and most recently in March, and every single time as you come down in the plane, you always see the blue tarps around the poorer neighborhoods of the San Juan area. And I'm sure that tomorrow I'm going to fly back in and I'm going to see those as well, which is concerning because hurricane season is a few weeks away. It starts June 1st.
And does your family have friends or family living in some of these more impacted areas?
No, thankfully. But again, everyone is struggling at different measures.
Sierra, let me get you in on the conversation. Some 900 families came to Philadelphia, what, last fall mostly?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, after September, October.
So that's, what, about 2,000 people
coming
into Philadelphia in a relatively short period of time?
Very short period, yeah.
Where are they living?
Well, right now, there are about 20, 21 families living in hotels with a FEMA assistance program that is a transitional kind of like hotel voucher. And a lot of people are living still with friends and families, basically kind of like moving from couch to couch, you know, from relative to relative. And other people have been able to find jobs and rent their own places.
We heard Danica say, you know, there's some question. Obviously, people have to make this very difficult decision about whether to, if they have left Puerto Rico, whether to go back or not. Based on your reporting and people that you've talked to, are they struggling with this? Are they thinking perhaps Philadelphia is a better place to call home than where they were in Puerto Rico?
Yeah, I think I've been talking mostly with the people more in need. So I would say people from lower income families that need assistance. And most of them feel like they already kind of like made it by coming here. And they see that here they have way more opportunities. Mm-hmm. Even like people who have been staying in hotels and don't necessarily have food for tomorrow or roof for tomorrow have told me like, I'm better here than there.
Wow.
Like there, I wouldn't have anything.
And when they came here, was it literally sort of packing up a suitcase or two and getting on an airplane and flying in?
Yeah, a lot of people came with nothing, just with a couple of things, and that's it.
Sierra, you've done a whole series of really compelling interviews with evacuees from Puerto Rico. This is the Voices of Maria. There were a couple of families I wanted you to talk about, the most recent ones that you have profiled, the Berdoy-Lewis family. Mm-hmm. Tell us about them.
Absolutely. So they are a family of five. I spoke with the mother and the three adolescent children. And, you know, they arrived to here because back home in Puerto Rico, it was just so, the situation was so harrowing. They were living near a dam, which was actually in danger of, you know, opening and imploding because the doors were failing.
I remember stories about that dam.
Yeah, and, you know, people, you know, there were people being evacuated from the area because of the fear that at any second that would explode. And their house was kind of in that area, and thankfully that didn't occur, but still having no electricity, no water, it was horrible. And, you know, they had family here in Philadelphia, so they came to the city. And they are living in a hotel in Center City.
I do want to talk about the whole people living in hotels, but this is a interesting family. They have three children. They did get into schools or go into schools in Philadelphia.
They did, and that's definitely helped normalize the situation because the children's school was interrupted. By the time they left, they still hadn't been able to go back to school, so they've been able to make friends and continue with their education here, which would have not been possible for a while had they stayed in Puerto Rico.
And as they told you, they have big dreams. Really inspiring big dreams.
Absolutely. The three kids, they all want to do different things. One wants to be a veterinarian. The other one wants to be a professional basketball player. And the other one would like to do music. So they hope that by staying here in the U.S., they can kind of, reach those and achieve them.
And how about work? I believe the husband has been able to find some work.
He has been able to find work, and hopefully they'll be able to find affordable housing soon because the hotels are going to be kicking out people soon, or FEMA will be kicking out people soon. So they would end up homeless and on the street if they were not able to find appropriate housing for them.
Well, let's talk about housing. And Catalina, as I was reading your stories and also Sierra, your stories as well, housing seemed to be so central to what these evacuees have needed. Philadelphia has its own problems with housing. Mm-hmm. How do you see the problem or the issue?
Well, it's very challenging for any city, right, to receive from 1 month to another, you have 900 families that need a place to stay. And even if you have the resources to rent an apartment, sometimes there's not availability of that housing, waiting for you. I mean, even if we are in a kind of a construction boom here in Philly, it's been very challenging for organizations and for city agencies who have been dealing to this to identify spaces for people to move into. As I said, 900 families, about 900 families came. We don't really know the numbers. What we know is how many people went to the disaster center that the Office of Emergency Management opened here in Philly. They opened a first center in October 11. Mm. 9 days after, 233 people already went there and registered. And then less than a month later, already 739 people. So in less than a month, 361 families went to that center. What this center was basically a big room in ASE, an Hispanic organization, mm-hmm. where different agencies of the city and the state gathered so people didn't have to go to get their driver's license to one place and then food stamps to another place. They kind of had everything together. They had people from FEMA. They have translators because the second biggest issue, I would say, after housing is language.
Right.
And then they had to move to a bigger center because more people kept coming. And that center closed in December 20.
So where do people go? So where have they been going?
That was kind of the first phase, right? Kind of the first phase of crisis and emergency response. I have to say that this has been a big challenge for the city. This is something that never happened before. Most of the emergency response agencies are used to dealing with a disaster that happened here, where people basically maybe were flooded or they had their houses, they had their jobs, and they had to move, and people have to fix their houses or something like that. But this is the first time where the city is having to react to a disaster that didn't happen in the city. It happened miles away. So this is also why for us in Plan Philly, we're kind of taking this as a case mm-hmm. of climate migration, because, of course, climate change or a big hurricane doesn't necessarily cause the migration. It just is one of a lot of other factors that triggers people to move. It is one of the big causes, right? So this is going to start happening more and more. I remember talking with Dan Bradley, the director of the Office of Emergency Management here in Philadelphia, and he was like, this is the first time. Wow. This is a unique moment because what happened is there's no resources. Like, if you have a disaster happening here, there's a lot of mechanisms that happen that open the door for resources. Federal resources, local resources, city resources. But here there was no resources. So people were like, okay, so we have all these people coming. They need all these services. Where are the resources for that? And they were like, oh, there's no resources.
Well, let me think about it, because you talk about at least early on having this place where everyone could come, and there were people at least representing, you know, either the city or nonprofits. Mm-hmm. So they were there, but they didn't have anything to offer these?
I mean, there's all these, like, so there's a bunch of community organizations and nonprofits, right, city agencies, a lot of Hispanic community here in Philly. And they all have their resources. But those resources are most of the time already designated to certain programs. So what I mean with no resources is like no extra resources.
Right.
In general, like when you have a crisis like this, for example, with Katrina, some cities were declared host cities, right? Like Houston at that time, which meant that the federal government gave them extra resources.
So why isn't Philly a host city?
Well, it hasn't been declared. There's this whole thing. There has been this whole thing because FEMA says that the governor of Puerto Rico has to ask for the governor of each state to declare the state, and then FEMA. So, it looks like these three people have to coordinate to declare a state a host state. And what has been happening is like we've been seeing like people kind of like throwing the ball to each other. I remember when Ricardo Rosselló, the governor of Puerto Rico, came to Philly in February, he said, like, I want to declare Pennsylvania a host state.
This seems a very fixable problem. Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Catalina Jaramillo. She's a reporter for Plan Philly at WHYY and also for State Impact Pennsylvania. Sierra Ortiz-Blanes is a freelance reporter, and we've been talking a bit about her series for Philadelphia Citizen called Voices of Maria. And we are talking about the crisis on the mainland or as a result of Hurricane Maria. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email at radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Sierra, I'm interested in the people that you have talked to, hearing Catalina describe the sort of bureaucracy that they have to deal with. Have they found that to be difficult?
Oh, absolutely. What you keep seeing is that people either are told by FEMA that they don't have the right documentation and they're bringing in everything, or that they just have difficulty accessing the people because of the language barriers. So the issue, again, is that there's no framework in place, like Catalina is saying, for this kind of situation. And then people are just kind of scrambling, and there's a community-organized response to it. But, you know, nonprofits, individual citizens, activists, and community leaders can't bear the burden or the weight of being able to help and situate so many people. So there's been a lot of focus on helping, you know, these evacuees, displaced folks, kind of navigating the FEMA system because it's so complicated. Right. Because, again, there's a language barrier, there's a bureaucratic barrier, so much documentation. A lot of people left their bills at home. They left any sorts of documents of identity at home because either their homes were destroyed or, you know, there wasn't what they were thinking about when they were coming to Philadelphia. So it's been very complicated in that sense.
You mentioned this family that you profiled that have been living in a hotel. My understanding is that they're going to have to leave, others that are also living in hotels, on the 14th of May.
Yeah. And
that's what, next week?
That's, yeah, actually.
I need to interrupt because actually last week
it was extended
June 30th.
Oh, to June 30th. Okay. Yeah. But still.
Yeah, but you know, with their case, for example, it was pretty easy going and smooth, the FEMA process, but at the same time, they still got mixed signals. So, for example, FEMA called them up being like, you have to leave the hotel in 2 days, and then they would call back and be like, no, you don't. So, can you imagine the trauma and the fear after having to leave your home and everything you know behind, coming into these temporary spaces and then being told by the system that's supposed to be in place to help you, you can't be here?
Catalina, I just want to underscore what you said because I think it's so important for us to think about what happened in Puerto Rico and the fact that 900 families came to Philadelphia, to think of these as you know, climate migrants. I mean, and with climate change happening around the world, islands are at particular risk because of rising sea levels and all the heavy storms that are associated with that. Mm-hmm. That this is something we have to think about. We, not just in Philadelphia, but as a country, we have to think about the fact that what's happening in Philadelphia is probably going to get repeated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And probably sooner rather than later.
Yeah. I've been talking with different kind of experts in security and migration, in urban planning, and what this is showing is that we have, like, cities have to think the way they respond to emergency in a different way. Mm-hmm. It, as I said, not necessarily to a disaster happening in their territories, mm-hmm. but something happening outside of their territories, how the resources get set up, how, I mean, we were so unprepared, for example, that, so this hotel program, right? FEMA, for hotels to be part of this program, they have to register.
They have to register
through
right.
FEMA. So
right.
when this when this was announced, I think like in October or something like that, that this resource existed, that FEMA was giving these vouchers, there was no hotel register in Philadelphia.
So they didn't want to, or they just didn't know about
it? I don't know
if
they didn't know, or like no one was thinking that this was going to be a possibility. Like, let's also realize that. Before this, no one, like the city, no one was thinking that this could happen. So OEA, like the Office of Emergency Management, had to kind of like do a campaign with hotels to say like, hey, register to this because we need hotels, you know? So like, that's the thing. There was no system in place. And imagine if the people coming from Puerto Rico was confused. Of course they were confused because like the city was confused. Mm-hmm. The agencies were confused. There was no systems. There were no relations.
No clear direction.
Let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Let me just quickly reintroduce our two guests. And again, we are talking about the fact that 900 families from Puerto Rico have relocated to Philadelphia after Hurricane Maria. Some might be staying, some might be going back, but certainly they are dealing with not just bureaucracy, but of course the loss of home and probably loss of family and community and neighbors. Catalina Jaramillo is a reporter for Plan Philly at WHYY and for State Impact Pennsylvania. Sierra Ortiz Blanes, again, a freelance reporter. She went to school here in Philly, and her recent series for the Philadelphia Citizen is called The Voices of Maria. You can join us. Any questions or comments or suggestions, 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Sierra Ortiz-Blanes and Catalina Jaramillo about Puerto Rico and the Puerto Ricans that have come to Philadelphia post-Hurricane Maria. And you can join our conversation. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Catalina, let me go back to you. But Sierra, I want to talk to you about another family that you profile. But you were saying, Catalina, that as much as things were really dire and not organized when these families came to Philadelphia, things are better now. And I always want to make sure that if there are problems, at least people are thinking about solutions. Where do we stand?
Yeah, things are getting better. So something kind of like exceptional happened, which is like a national organization of volunteers for disaster response called National VOAD.
VOAD?
They opened a local group of that for southeastern Pennsylvania, especially for evacuees, which is something that apparently has never happened before, like to create this kind of group for responding for evacuees. So this is the Greater Philadelphia Long-Term Recovery Committee, where there are 12 voting members, there are organizations, Hispanic organizations, and city agencies, and 35 community partners. So this group have been meeting and organizing themselves to gather funds coming from different parts and to kind of like they did different committees. One is the housing committee. The other one is the case management, spiritual and emotional care. And they've been trying to put the systems that they were not there, make these relations that were not there, and finally they're in a spot where, like, okay, they kind of like know the resources available, they have the ways of bringing those resources and giving them to people, they know who are here, who needs more help, and like what's kind of like the
hierarchy of right. needs,
and they've been able to establish a plan. So after the June 30th deadline, where these people have to move from hotels, they already have rental assistance for these people. It depends in each case. It will depend on their financial situation, their medical situation. If they get, for example, first, last, and security deposit, if they get some kind of food assistance, medical assistance, transportation, you name it. And there's also help not only for the people in hotels, but they will also identify about 30 to 40 families who are staying with friends or families that
maybe living on a couch or
that. You know, you've been a guest in your friend's or family's house. Like after like 3 weeks, you're like, okay,
time to go.
These people have been staying for 8 months. Right. So they need a place to stay.
Well, that's good. And hopefully a model for the future, either for Philly or for other cities as well. Sarah, let me go back to you and again to another family that you profiled, the Cabrera family. Tell us about them. They lived in what sounds like a more mountainous part of Puerto Rico.
Yes. I mean, both the Burdo y Luis and the Cabrera family are both from outside the metropolitan area, but the Cabrera family even more so. And, you know, their house was damaged and their landlord told them you cannot return. And so they decided to come here again because they had family. A lot of evacuees are coming into Philadelphia because of the very strong Puerto Rico-Philadelphia ties. There's a lot of us here. And they've been living with family members as well since November. Mm. And they're still there. And I think that their situation represents the entrenchment and the limbo in which a lot of evacuees find themselves in. They are living temporarily in their relatives' homes, so they don't have the stress of being kicked out necessarily, which the people living in hotels do, but it's still a stressful situation. They're living in very cramped conditions, and they're actively trying to find housing, but the places around the area are not affordable. Irma, the mother of the family, is the one who looks for houses while her husband works. Yeah. But she can't really leave the area because she can't necessarily afford transportation. So she walks for hours at a time. And then she either gets turned away or she can't communicate with landlords because she only speaks
Spanish.
She's on
her own, it sounds like.
She is. And it's every night she was telling me she just collapses into bed from exhaustion. And their kids are going to school, but they're having a difficult time because they're adjusting to this completely new environment. There's again the language barrier; they speak more English than their parents. But it's just a journey into this unknown, in which they have a lot of odds against them, and it's difficult.
Well, and it's painful to read about what they've been through. And apparently, after Hurricane Maria, I mean, no one came to help them. No government. No nobody. They were, I mean, again, on their own.
But that happened with a lot of rural communities in the mountains, right. Because in Puerto Rico, you have a lot of neighborhoods that are kind of hidden away or not on main roads. So when FEMA came to help, they don't necessarily have an understanding of that geography or those maps. So a lot of folks were just left on their own for weeks.
Yeah. And it makes you wonder, so thinking about this family, the Cabrera family, the other family felt like, well, this might be a place we could actually put down roots and find a future. I don't feel that way about this family.
They're trying to figure it out. Yeah. But you know what? Back to what we were talking about earlier, what Danica was talking about, the uncertainty of being here for a lot of families is better than no hope at all back home. And that's a very heavy reality to deal with.
Did you find families were eager to talk to you?
Absolutely, and that was also a really, really fulfilling as a writer, as a journalist, and as a Puerto Rican, kind of having the opportunity to give a platform for people who don't speak the language here, who aren't being asked these questions. I think for a while, this evacuee crisis was invisible to the city.
Because people just almost, not disappeared, but it felt as if they almost disappeared into the city somewhere.
Yeah,
no one knew they were here.
Exactly, and they flocked to Puerto Rican neighborhoods, which are already historically the poorest neighborhoods in Philadelphia. Some interviews went on for 4 and 5 hours because just people having the opportunity to speak I think was very empowering.
Which makes you think about the kind of, I'm not saying therapy exactly, but counseling or someone to Catalina to hear their stories and how important that is for someone's well-being and feeling that they are not alone.
Yeah, and that's what these organizations are also identifying as the next steps. I mean, now that the housing situation or crisis is kind of like moving into a place that it's a little bit better, all of these things are going to be a big priority, spiritual and emotional care. We were seeing a lot of suicides in Puerto Rico recently.
As a result of just this
of the hurricane. Yeah, there's also, I mean, we know that mental health is a big issue. These people have been under a lot of stress. So, yeah, that's going to be one of the big next steps together with other stuff. Like once you have housing, you also need furniture and you need other stuff to survive, right? You need money for groceries, as we were saying. Jobs and language is a big, big issue. If you don't speak English, it's hard to get a job. If you don't get a job, you cannot pay your bills.
And has it, a number of the families that you profiled, Sierra, they have been able to find work. It sounds like maybe some is under the table, some not. I mean, these are American citizens, we should say. So.
Yeah, let's say that.
Yeah, let's say that, just to underscore what we're talking about. But jobs, how challenging has that been?
It depends. I think, again, with the linguistic barrier can be almost insurmountable. People are just scrambling to whatever they can find. And hopefully the situation will change as they kind of settle in. They start meeting people. Mm-hmm. But for now, some people are, you know, still looking every day for a job since they arrived, handing out resumes, dropping them off at every single business that they can. Other people are more settled. But still, even finding a job does not guarantee housing or stability, because a lot of these folks are working, as you said, under the table jobs, or just jobs that don't provide for families of 4 and 5. Mm-hmm. And those incomes are just not, and in other cases, you have families with young children, so one parent can work and the other one can't. So there's just all these other factors that go just beyond having a job. You know, the wage and the family structure. Yeah.
Well, I was also reading about even if you got a professional degree or certificate in Puerto Rico, that may not translate to Philadelphia or to the mainland. I mean, it's just what you learned or know there might not translate so much. You're saying yes, Catalina?
Yeah, I heard that. I mean, I've also covered a little bit of what's going on in Camden, because there's also a big population of Puerto Ricans there. The New Jersey established a Commission of Puerto Rican Relief with 18 members, and one of the big issues they were dealing with was with professional licenses, and this being a barrier for people to find jobs in what they studied for, and instead of like being able to work as whatever their profession was, they were getting very low paid jobs, and that's just like a kind of like a bureaucratic thing of like, because Puerto Rico is not, again, recognized as all the other states in this country, that is creating a problem.
Well, and it's interesting, Danica Cotto touched on this earlier about whether this notion of statehood, mm-hmm. you know, becomes more salient, or even, I'm looking at you, Sierra, because you've got family there, about whether all of a sudden that seems like an option that, and I know there have been some, I guess, disagreement or divided polls about statehood versus independence versus whatever.
I think that's assuming that the power of whether Puerto Rico can be a state is in Puerto Rican hands. And it's just not, right? Like, I mean, I'm not going to go into my own politics, because that's a story of all of its own. Puerto Rico is very divided. But I personally don't think that statehood is viable, because that would assume that the United States wants us as a state in the first place. And we've been stuck as a colony, territory, whatever you'd like to call it, for over 100 years. And it doesn't seem to be changing anytime soon, particularly the time where Puerto Rico's on the ground. I think we're going to be stuck in the limbo that we are for a while.
Do you see it that way, Catalina?
I was going to add another thing, sorry. Like, also in the political side of this, once Puerto Ricans move to the mainland, they have voting rights. So that has been also another big thing where both Democratic and Republicans have been trying to kind of like
capitalize
this new voters coming here. And there's a big effort of like making these people vote, and in that way also helping the Puerto Ricans in the island.
Sierra.
And I think on that note, regardless of the future of Puerto Rico's political status, I think that if Puerto Ricans are able to organize effectively here in the United States, we can enact some policy that might help Puerto Rico rebuild. And I think particularly there's already a movement of folks who are trying to register Puerto Ricans in Pennsylvania. I forgot the name. So I think that, again, it'll be important to kind of wield that influence, but I think it'll be important to mobilize and organize Puerto Ricans so that they might have the option to vote people who are going to help us.
Us.
Yeah.
Catalina, you mentioned Southeastern Pennsylvania, VOAD, VOAD.
SIPA VOAD.
SIPA VOAD. And this is this group that's looking at long-term recovery, hopefully some lessons learned and applying them going forward. Mm-hmm. Does it feel as if things are now in place and that the money is there and that people can get the services, the help that they need?
Yeah. I was speaking yesterday for a story that we're going to publish today in Plan Philly with Julia Manso. She's the leader of this group. And she was saying, it looks like finally we're moving to a recovery phase instead of this kind of like
emergency
crisis of like looking into what are they going to eat tomorrow, where are they going to sleep tomorrow, and like what are they going to do tomorrow, and more like looking into the big picture of how can they support these families to become sustainable and self-sufficient.
Sierra, you had a piece in the Philadelphia Inquirer on Sunday. Philadelphia can aid Puerto Rican hurricane victims this way and include a number of things that individuals can do, such as?
Absolutely. I think that citizen action in these kinds of situations is really important. I think that it's important for people to kind of look at their resources, their talents, and think critically about how they can help. So, for example, if you teach English classes, you can offer classes at a reduced cost or for free to Puerto Ricans. You can reach out to APM, which is Asociación de Puertorriqueños en Marcha, or Liliana Marrero Library. If you're a landlord and you have a Puerto Rican evacuee coming in, you can forego first and last deposit because that's a really big barrier. They just don't have that kind of money. If you, for example, provide extracurricular programming or sports programming for youth, you can invite Puerto Rican youth who are really, some of them are really bored because they don't know people and they're starting to get to know people, so you can kind of invite them to join in. So I think, again, everyone has something to offer in this situation. So it's just a question of looking inside and figuring out what you can give.
And how would you find someone? I mean, how would you find a bored teenager from Puerto Rico?
I think just connecting with the organizations that are in place helping. So the Greater Philadelphia Long-Term Recovery Committee, the Lilian Marrero Library, the free library branch in Fairhill has been doing fantastic work. They're actually organizing Saturday office hours, emergency hours, where people can come in. Where evacuees come in and they help them with their needs and their FEMA applications, so you can come in and volunteer an afternoon there and just help evacuees speak on the phone with FEMA.
Taller Puertorriqueño. Ceiba, yeah. Congreso, Salvation Army, Lutheran Services. There's a bunch of organizations working.
Mm-hmm. And they all know people who need help.
We're going to end on that note. My thanks to both of you for coming in and joining us today on Radio Times. Thank you so much. Catalina Jaramillo, a reporter for Plan Philly at WHYY and for State Impact Pennsylvania, also at WHYY. Catalina, nice to have you with us. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. Sierra Ortiz Blanes, again, a freelance reporter, and again, her series for The Philadelphia Citizen is called The Voices of Maria. Sierra, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program. You can also download a podcast of the show. You can go to iTunes or Stitcher or wherever you get your podcasts. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder and John Ahrens, with assistance from Alex Stern. I'm Marty Moscone. Thank you for joining us.